approximately preserves all physical quantities. So when I say approximate stimulation, what I mean is that both of these two conditions, you relax them slightly. And I won't go through the exact definition of what it means to relax both these conditions slightly, but you can define it in a mathematically rigorous way. And what you find when you do that is that all the kind of approximations you introduce to these two conditions, they map to kind of small areas in the time dynamics and energy levels and all the other properties we're interested in. Okay, so we're allowed to use approximate simulations. We don't require that all our conditions hold exactly. Does that help us? Can we build interesting simulations now that we're allowed to look at approximate systems? And the answer is yes. And one very powerful technique to build these approximate simulations is perturbation gadgets. So perturbation gadgets are techniques which have come through from Hamiltonian complexity theory. And they're really used to take complicated systems and reduce them down to much simpler systems. So what perturbation gadgets allow us to do in the simulation sense is take very complicated systems and simulate them with very simple systems. Okay, so what do I mean by a perturbation gadget? Well, the idea of a perturbation gadget is that you take two Hamiltonians, one of which is weighted very heavily, and one of which is got a much smaller norm. If you add these two Hamiltonians together, then you can construct an effective Hamiltonian in the low energy subspace of the overall system. And this effective Hamiltonian will often have much more kind of a much more complicated structure than either of the two Hamiltonians you began with. So we use lots of different perturbation gadgets in our work, but I'm just going to give you an example of one here. So the Hamiltonian we start with is given by this picture here. So what we have is 5 qubits, where there are interactions between the qubits wherever there's a line on this graph. The interactions between the qubits here, this is our H1. So all of these interactions are not heavyweight. We then introduce an H0 interaction. So this is our very heavily weighted interaction. And this is just a projector onto this central qubit here. So we're just projecting this central qubit into a one-dimensional ground space. What you find is when you go through the perturbation techniques is that the low energy subspace of this Hamiltonian is actually equivalent to this Hamiltonian here. So what we have here is because we've projected the central qubit into a one-dimensional ground space, it's not appearing in this interaction at all. And instead what's happening is it's mediating interactions between these between qubits A and D and qubits B and C, which weren't interacting in the original system. So what these kind of techniques allow us to do is they allow us to take systems like this one on the right, which have crossings, which maybe we don't want to have allow in our interaction graph, and simulate them with systems like this system on the left, or, well, your left, yeah, where there's no crossings in the interaction graph. And as I said, this is just one example of a type of perturbation gadget you might construct. There are many other types of perturbation gadgets. And what was shown in this paper from 2018 was that using these perturbation gadget techniques, any Hamiltonian at all you can write down acting on any local dimension of qubits or on a graph of any kind of interaction, complicated interaction graph, they can all be approximately stimulated by certain simple 2D spin lattice models using perturbation gadgets. So this is interesting for ADS-CFT. We know that any Hamiltonian you can write down can be simulated by a local Hamiltonian on a 2D lattice. And the only problem really with the happy code was that the Hamiltonian it mapped on the boundary wasn't local. But now we have a way to make any Hamiltonian local. So the idea is really, can we use these simulation techniques along with a holographic quantum error correcting code, so something like a happy code from a 3D bulk to a 2D boundary, to construct a toy model of holographic duality between local Hamiltonians? And the answer kind of obviously is yes, because that's what we've done in this work. So in this section of the talk, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the technical details, so how this construction actually works. Okay, so I said we can simulate any Hamiltonian at all using simple 2D spin lattice models. But in the happy code, the bulk in the happy code is two-dimensional, but the boundary is only one-dimensional. And the thing we want to simulate is the boundary. We don't have any methods yet for constructing a 1D local boundary simulation. So we're going to need to generalize the happy code up a dimension. So we're going to need a tensor network toy model of ADS-CFT, where the bulk is three-dimensional and the boundary is two-dimensional. And at first, we thought this would be the kind of very nice, easy part of the construction to make work. We could do it in exactly the same way as we did in the happy paper. We take a tessellation of hyperbolic three space, in this case by right-angled dodecahedrons, take a perfect tensor, and embed a tensor network in this tessellation by having one tensor for each cell of the tessellation. One of the indices of the tensor is left uncontracted. All the other ones are contracted with indices of neighboring tensors. And just as before, we cut off the tessellation at some finite radius, and the uncontracted tensor indices on the boundary, those are our boundary degrees of freedom. Okay, so that sounds easy enough, but unfortunately it wasn't that easy. And the problem is, just having perfect tensors and just having a tessellation of hyperbolic space, that isn't enough to guarantee that this tensor network has the properties we need. So it's not enough to guarantee that it's an isometry from bulk to boundary. It's not enough to guarantee that it's an error-correcting code. And it's not even enough to guarantee that we have all kind of the nice features of ADS-CFT we want. And the issue is, we need a way to analyze the properties of this tessellation. And when you're working in two-dimensional hyperbolic space, that's relatively simple. You can use computers to generate images of tessellations, and you can analyze them visually, really, just by eye. But you can't analyze three-dimensional tessellations just by looking at them, because you end up with images like this, which are difficult to get any useful information out of. And the problem really only gets worse if you wanted to generalize this to higher dimensions. And so what we needed was an analytical way to analyze these tessellations and make sure they have the properties we needed to construct these toy models. So after some reading around to try and find the right techniques, we came across the theory of hyperbolic Coxeter groups. So a Coxeter group is a group which is defined by involutions. So you take some set of involutions and define relations between them by this matrix M. So we have that this matrix is one down the diagonal, and it's symmetric, and all its other entries are integers. We then define a Coxeter group by this presentation. So we take this group, which is defined by these generators, and the fact that MII equals one enforces that all these generators are involutions. Now, a general Coxeter group will have many different generating sets. And for our work, we're really interested not just in the properties of the group itself, but in the properties of the group with respect to a particular set. So we're going to take a pair of a Coxeter group with a particular choice of generating set and call that a Coxeter system. Okay, so these Coxeter systems have been very, very well studied. But what have they got to do with hyperbolic tessellations? Why are they useful for us? In order to see how they're useful for us, we need to look at the definition of a Coxeter polytope. So a Coxeter polytope living in any geometry is just a polytope which has all of its dihedral angles into just the multiples of pi. And we're interested in Coxeter polytopes because if you take a Coxeter polytope living in hyperbolic space, that polytope will tessellate that space. And as the name suggests, Coxeter polytopes are very closely related to Coxeter systems. And in fact, take any Coxeter polytope you like, living in any geometry, tiling that geometry, and you can write down a Coxeter system which is associated to that polytope. So the way that works, the generators of this Coxeter system are defined to be reflections on the faces of the Coxeter polytope. And these relations between these generators that I mentioned earlier, these are given by the dihedral angles between the faces of the polytope. And this is useful because what you can show is that all the interesting properties of the tessellation that we needed to get a handle on in order to be able to study these tensor networks, these can all be inferred from the Coxeter system. So we don't need to worry about visualizing hyperbolic three space. We can just pick a tessellation, write down the associated Coxeter system, and then we have a way to reason algebraically about the tensor network. Okay, so now we've got a handle. We've got a way to read. Now we've got this kind of theory of hyperbolic Hochster groups in our toolbox. We have a way to reason algebraically about the properties of our perfect tensor network. So in particular, we can derive a condition for the tensor network to be an isometry from bulk to boundary. And with this condition, we were able to find tessellations and perfect tensors which match that condition. So in particular, this tessellation by right-angled dodecahedrons, it does have the properties we need in order to construct a toy model of ADS-CFT. We're also able to determine the properties of the boundary Hilbert space. So what I mean by this is we can determine what geometry the boundary Hilbert space is living in. And if we take any operator living in the bulk, we can use the properties of this tessellation to determine what the weight of that operator is on the boundary. So how much do bulk operators spread out when they're mapped to the boundary? Okay, so we've got this tessellation, we've got this tensor network, and we have a way to analyze it. So now let's start adding Hamiltonians in. So the Hamiltonian simulation we're going to do it in two steps. The first step is we're going to construct a perfect simulation which maps us from the bulk Hilbert space to the boundary Hilbert space. But this perfect simulation won't give us a local Hamiltonian on the boundary. We're then going to use approximate simulation to give us a local Hamiltonian on the boundary. Okay, so how do we construct a non-local boundary Hamiltonian, which is the perfect simulation of H bulk? For each tensor in the tensor network, we're going to construct this projector. What this projector is remember that each tensor in the tensor network itself defines an error-correcting code. So the tensor network as a whole is an error-correcting code, but each tensor individually is also an error-correcting code. And for each tensor, we're going to construct a projector which projects onto the code space of the error-correcting code defined by that tensor. And that's going to form one part of our perfect simulation. The other part of our perfect simulation is just taking the bulk Hamiltonian and mapping it through the isometry defined by the tensor network. So what we have, our perfect simulation is equal to this encoded version of the bulk Hamiltonian plus the sum over all of these individual projectors, where we apply some heavily weighted energy penalty to the projector onto the complement of all these code spaces. And if you compare this Hamiltonian with the definition of perfect simulation that I gave you a few slides ago, you can see that this Hamiltonian is this non-local boundary Hamiltonian is a perfect simulation of the bulk Hamiltonian. And so what that means is that all the physics of the bulk is perfectly replicated in our boundary system. But this Hamiltonian is non-local. And it's non-local because both of these terms here are non-local. This first term is non-local. Oh, sorry, yes. So if you didn't have this HS, we would find this would be an example of an encoding. So we'd be encoding the boundary Hamiltonian into a subspace of the we're encoding the bulk Hamiltonian into a subspace of the boundary. But without this kind of delta S, we're not pushing the other energy levels up to some high energy. We're not pushing the other subspace up to some high energy. And the reason why we have these kind of the sum over projectors rather than just a simple projector will hopefully become clear later. OK, so this is a perfect simulation, but it's completely non-local. So how are we going to improve on this to give us a local Hamiltonian on the boundary? Well, we do that using these approximate simulation techniques, using these perturbation gadgets that I mentioned earlier. So I won't talk about the perturbation gadgets in any detail, but I'll just give you a flavor of the types of gadgets we need to use to build this approximate simulation. So the first type of gadget we use is a subdivision gadget. So what the subdivision gadget does is it allows you to take highly non-local operators and break them down into local ones. So what we have here in this picture, on the right, we have an operator, M1, between two subsets of qubits, A and B, where, let's say, A and B both contain k qubits. So what we have here is a 2k local operator. Now, using the perturbation gadget techniques that I mentioned earlier, we can break this system down into 2k local operators. And the way we do that, we introduce a ancilla qubit W. And as before, we apply some heavily weighted projector onto this ancilla qubit. So that in the low energy subspace of this overall system, this ancilla is projected into a one-dimensional ground space. And what we find is that these two interactions generate an effective interaction, which is so this is a technique we can use to take this global Hamiltonian we have on the boundary and break it down into a two-local Hamiltonian. Okay, but when we do that, what we'll find is that we end up with an interaction graph on the boundary, which contains many crossings. And that's problematic because then it's no longer really an interaction graph that lives in two dimensions. So we want to remove these crossings, and we do that using the crossing gadget that I mentioned earlier. Once we've removed the crossings from the interaction graph, we then apply another gadget known as a fork gadget. And what this gadget does is it allows us to break down, decrease the degree of high degree vertices in the interaction graph. So once we've applied all these perturbation gadgets, what we end up with is a 2D interaction graph, which is a 2D lattice interaction graph. We actually also use some slightly more complicated perturbation gadgets, which allow us to also introduce some symmetries into the boundary model. And what we find as a final boundary model that we end up with is a local boundary Hamiltonian of this form. So it has full SU2 local symmetry. As I said before, it's acting on a 2D lattice. So it's a nice, simple Hamiltonian, just of the form we wanted for our boundary Hamiltonian. But in each of these steps here, I was adding in ancillas into the system. And you might wonder, how much have we had to blow up the Hilbert space and the boundary? Have we had to kind of add in so many ancilla qubits? We can't really call this, but this boundary we've ended up with isn't really a boundary of the system we started with in the end. And the answer to this is no. So we have had to blow up the number of qubits on the boundary a bit, but the number of additional qubits only scales as poly log n. So we haven't blown up the local dimension very much, the Hilbert space dimension very much. And this scaling really is where we use the structural features of ADS-CFT. So it was obvious from the simulation results that it was possible to construct a tensor network toy model like this, where the boundary Hamiltonian was local. What wasn't necessarily obvious was that we could do it with reasonable scaling. The other thing that wasn't obvious was that we could do it while preserving all the interesting structural features of ADS-CFT. What we show in the paper is we have managed to do that. So in building this approximate simulation in the boundary, we haven't mucked up the locality structure, so or the entanglement structure of the initial system. Okay, so now we have this nice tensor network toy model of ADS-CFT, where we find that local Hamiltonians in the bulk map to local Hamiltonians in the boundary. But what can we use that for? The first thing we use it for in our paper is to construct a map from the boundary to the bulk. So when I spoke about, kind of gave you that very brief introduction to ADS-CFT at the beginning of the talk, I said it's duality between bulk and boundary. I didn't say it's a map from the bulk to the boundary. It's a duality that's meant to go in both directions. But in the happy code, and when we're building our tensor network construction as well, we're really building a map from the bulk to the boundary. It's a tensor network that maps bulk degrees of freedom to boundary degrees of freedom. And it would be nice to have a map going in the other direction. What we find using the perturbative techniques we've introduced in this construction, we are able to build a map from the boundary to the bulk. In order to do that, we need to decompose the boundary Hamiltonian into three terms. So this term here on the far left, this is just the encoded bulk Hamiltonian. So this is a Hamiltonian you get from taking, these are the terms that come from taking the bulk Hamiltonian and mapping it to the boundary. The second term here, delta S HS, this HS is the term you get from mapping the stabilizers of the error correcting code to the boundary. And delta S is some heavily weighted energy penalty, which we give to all states on the boundary which live outside the code subspace. This final term here, delta L, HL, these are terms that come from the perturbative simulations. So delta L is, some heavily weighted energy penalty, and in particular, delta L is much bigger than delta S. And what we find is that above delta L, the entire simulation just breaks down. So above delta L, at energies above delta L, there's really no meaningful duality anymore. So for the purposes of the rest of this talk, we can just assume that delta L is infinity. Okay, so once we've broken down the Hamiltonian in this form, we can consider the boundary Hamiltonian, which is dual to the zero Hamiltonian in the bulk. So all that is we set this H bulk term to zero. And what we find is that we can recover a geometric interpretation of the bulk from this equation.
Sorry. So here, we've started with like a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Mm.
Yeah.
Which you've constructed from the bulk?
Yes, we've constructed this from the bulk.
And this always lives on a triangulation of the two.
Yeah, we can always choose it to live on that. Cool. Okay, so we can decompose. Okay, so we're going to recover a geometric interpretation of the bulk from this equation. The way we do that is we decompose the boundary Hilbert space into subspaces of energy E, where each subspace, the lowest energy subspace has energy between 0 and 1/2 delta S. And then the energy of each subspace goes up in multiples of delta S. And what we find is that H generic, if you kind of restrict yourself to the subspaces of energy less than delta L, H generic is block diagonal with respect to this decomposition. So what does that mean? Well, if we take our boundary Hamiltonian, we can write it in this form, where we have one subspace of energy zero, one subspace of energy delta S, and so on. Okay, but what's this got to do with geometry? What's the geometric interpretation of this tensor sum structure? This direct sum structure. Well, I said the delta S, the HS terms in the Hamiltonian, they come from the stabilizers of the tensor network. So if we're in this subspace, if we have energy delta S, what that means is that we violated exactly one of the stabilizers of the tensor network. If we have energy 2 delta S, we violated exactly 2 of the stabilizers of the tensor network. So that's what I mean when I say we can recover this geometric kind of interpretation of this equation. If we're in this subspace, we must have violated one of the tensors of the tensor network. One of the stabilizers. And on the boundary, violating one of the stabilizers makes absolute sense. But in the bulk, you can't talk about violating the stabilizers unless you've removed one of the tensors from the tensor network. And that's really where this geometric interpretation comes from. And what's more, within each of these subspaces, you can actually, the Hilbert space decomposes further, because it's not just one way which we could remove a tensor from this tensor network. There's many ways. So what we find is actually a picture more like this. We've got this block diagonal structure, where what block you're in tells you how many tensors you've removed from the tensor network, and then which sub-block you're in tells you which tensors you've removed. Okay, so this is nice. It gives us a geometric way to understand the boundary Hamiltonian, but it doesn't give us a way to map the boundary to the bulk immediately. So in order to see how we map from the boundary to the bulk, what we need to do is we need to, for each of these subspaces, we can define an isometry. And all these isometries are different. And these are the isometries which are defined by this tensor network with that tensor removed. We can then take a direct sum over all of these isometries. Then we can take any boundary state where we're not insisting that this boundary state lives in any of these subspaces. The boundary state can live in any of the subspaces. And we can map it through this unit tree to calculate the corresponding bulk state. And what we find in general is that these bulk states will be some superposition over different bulk geometries. Okay, so that gives us a way to map states from the boundary to the bulk. What about mapping Hamiltonians?
The first block decomposition pattern, I'm supposed to interpret those as code subspaces of states of different energy black holes?
Yes. Well, no, the energy of each black, sorry. The energy in this block, the energies of all the black holes are the same. In this block, yeah, you've got bigger black holes, so they have higher energy. Or you might have two smaller black holes, which again will have higher energy. Okay, so that's how we map states from the boundary to the bulk. But what about mapping Hamiltonians? Well, it's very easy to map a Hamiltonian which has a block diagonal form from the boundary to the bulk. We can just push it through for each term in the decomposition. We can push it through the appropriate isometry and construct the bulk Hamiltonian acting on the right geometry. But what about if we had more interesting boundary Hamiltonians and we wanted to map those to the bulk? Well, we can still do the same thing. We can still take each term in this decomposition. Each block diagonal term in the decomposition can be mapped through the appropriate isometry. And we will see, we'll get an approximation to how this boundary Hamiltonian acts on the bulk defined by that geometry. But importantly, this is now only an approximation. There's also going to be interactions between the different bulk geometries. And what that tells us is that it's possible for these different bulk geometries to continuously evolve. It's possible to continuously evolve from one bulk geometry to another bulk geometry. And what this really suggests is that the tensor network description is only an approximation to the underlying bulk physics. Okay, so we've now got a way to map from boundary to bulk. That's something we didn't have in the previous tensor network, so that's nice. But I said that the main kind of motivation for studying local Hamiltonians was that it gave us a way to study energy scales and dynamics. And I haven't said anything about that yet. So before I finish up, I'm going to briefly talk about black holes and black hole formation and how that can tell us something about and how we can use this model to study energy scales and dynamics. I should say for the rest of the talk, all the pictures are going to be two-dimensional because I can't draw in three dimensions. But obviously, because our techniques only work in two dimensions, you should pretend it's all three-dimensional. Okay, so in this happy code, the earlier paper which we build on in our toy model, it was suggested that you can model black holes by removing a tensor from the tensor network. Now, we've just seen in our construction, I won't go back, it's a bit of a way back, but when you do that, what you find is that the boundary state is a state of high energy. And that's nice because that's what we expect for black holes in ADS-CFT to be dual to high energy states on the boundary. And there were some other reasons as well in the happy paper why this was a reasonable way to think about black holes, why this was a reasonable way to model black holes in this toy model. But it might seem a little bit ad hoc. We remove a tensor from the tensor network and we say it's a black hole. Can we give any more reason to believe that this is the right way to think about black holes in these tensor network toy models? And in our paper, using the kind of Hamiltonian we have on the boundary, we can. So the way we do this is we look at how black holes might form in these tensor network toy models. So what we do is we start with some Hamiltonian in the bulk, which is local, and which we choose to model semi-classical gravity. So we don't write down any particular Hamiltonian. We just argue that it is possible to write down a Hamiltonian which models semi-classical gravity in the bulk. We're then going to set up the parameters in our model in such a way that our delta S parameter, which remember is an energy penalty we give to states which leave the code subspace on the boundary, we choose this parameter such that it's greater than any of the individual interaction terms in our bulk Hamiltonian, but it's less than the sum over the entire bulk Hamiltonian. Okay, we're then going to start in the ground state of our bulk Hamiltonian. And then we apply some local bulk excitations. So we take a ring of qubits near the boundary of our tensor network, and we apply some local excitation to that ring of qubits. Now we can take that those excitations and map them out to the boundary. And because all we've done is apply logical operators in the error correcting language, when we map this operation out to the boundary, we'll still be in the code space. But if we pick up the parameters of our model correctly, we can set this up in such a way that the energy on the boundary is greater than delta S. So we're still in the low energy we're still in the code subspace, but we've got energy which is greater than this energy penalty delta S. Okay, we're then going to let this system evolve under the bulk Hamiltonian. What we have here is something which we can model as a shell of matter, and we've got a Hamiltonian that models semi-classical gravity. So if we let the system evolve under our bulk Hamiltonian, what we'll find is that the shell of matter will fall inwards. If we let it evolve for long enough, eventually we'll end up in a system, in a situation where the system is picking up energy from order one bulk terms. Now, this evolution has been entirely unitary. We're just evolving under a Hamiltonian, so we must still have energy greater than delta S. But we can't pick up energy greater than delta S from order one bulk terms because of the way we chose the parameters initially in the model. And what we show in the paper is that the only way to conserve energy under unitary dynamics is to violate one of the stabilizer terms of the error correcting code. And on the boundary, that absolutely makes sense. We start in a state with energy greater than delta S, we evolve it unitarily, and we end up in a state with energy greater than delta S, but we've just moved from the code subspace out of the code subspace. On the bulk, though, it doesn't seem to make sense at all. You know, we started with a Hilbert space of a complete tensor network, and we end up in a Hilbert space where we've removed from the tensor network. And it kind of appears to be a very non-unitary kind of operation that you put in by hand. And what we argue in the paper is the reason this operation doesn't kind of look right when you're looking at the bulk physics is because the tensor network is only an approximation to the underlying physics. So this kind of evolution looks odd and non-unitary if you're looking at it in the bulk, because all we're looking at is an approximation. And you need to look at the boundary, which is where you need to look at the boundary to see what's kind of the real evolution, the non-approximate evolution that's going on. So essentially what's happened here is the low energy approximation is broken down. We've left the semi-classical geometry, and we've had to move between these different geometries defined by these different tensor networks. Okay, so thank you for your time. So just to conclude, what we've done here is we've constructed a toy model of holographic duality where the bulk boundary mapping is between local Hamiltonians. And this allows us to incorporate energy scales and dynamics into the model, and it allows us to construct a model from boundary to bulk. And these constructions and this looking at the energy scales and the time dynamics, it does tell us something about these tensor network toy models. It gives us some intuition for how we should think about these tensor network toy models. But I think one of the most interesting open questions is, at what point do these toy models break down? So one important thing to stress is that at no point in this kind of construction do we rely on the fact that the bulk physics is gravitational. You know, we could put any Hamiltonian we wanted into the bulk and map it to the boundary, and we'd get a local Hamiltonian on the boundary, we'd get the error correcting properties of ADS-CFT. You know, we'd have a toy model of ADS-CFT with completely non-gravitational systems in the bulk. And you shouldn't be able to do that, really. You know, ADS-CFT is meant to be a statement about quantum gravity, not a statement about negatively curved space. So I think it's interesting to ask, you know, what features of ADS-CFT are we missing? Is it possible to construct toy models which also incorporate those features? And if not, maybe that's telling us something about what's special about gravity. So I think that's an interesting kind of future avenue for research. Yeah, thank you.
Good questions.
So there was something I think a couple of slides ago that there's this delta S is smaller than sum of AC. So AC, what is this?
So if we have our bulk Hamiltonian is a sum over these local terms.
Yeah, right, then. So to do this decomposition in the field of space into like these sectors, do you know how is that compatible with this?
So this is the bulk, sorry. Okay, yeah, so this is the point where everything gets a little bit hand wavy. So you can still break the Hilbert space down into these sectors, but now the energies will.
The energy will define
the space. Yeah, so it's no longer the case that this Hilbert space is energy zero, this kind of subspace is energy zero, and this is subspace is energy delta s. We now have that this subspace contains some eigenvectors of energy delta s.
So I guess in any case, what you're arguing is that you can prepare this pure state which has energy high enough.
Yeah, so we're still living in a different we're still kind of in a different subspace, but now the energies of the subspaces aren't. So we're not breaking it down corresponding to the energy anymore, we're breaking it down corresponding to whether there are stabilizers which have been violated.
If I start with just a single, you're like a symmetric boundary perturbation.
Mm.
If I just start with a single boundary perturbation, do I still have to argue that I would, like, and then follow the dynamics of the bulk, do I still have to argue that I need to remove the tensors?
No, so if you start with just a single one, then that if you're only acting on order one kind of to begin with, you would never.
Is it order one? Like each of these tensors is like bulk ABS scale energy. So am I acting with very high energy necessarily with a single boundary perturbation? Or yeah, maybe just if I just do a single perturbation,
yeah.
Single excitation.
So if you do just a single perturbation, you'll never leave the code subspace because that single perturbation is a logical operator, so it maps to something acting on the logical Hilbert space on the boundary. Whether it would then evolve something outside of the code subspace, it's not obvious that it definitely wouldn't, but you definitely can't show using our techniques that it definitely would. Because our techniques rely on the fact that we start with energy greater than delta S, and you can't do that with just one perturbation.
But at this scale, it's not like I could derive something like a bulk orbit from how that perturbation
no.
Like moves around.
I mean, yeah, you'd have to actually construct the bulk Hamiltonian. It wouldn't be enough to just say, oh, it models classical gravity in some hand-wavy way.
But maybe that's possible?
Yeah, I think if we had powerful enough computers to kind of compute these evolutions, and also if we knew what was a good model to put into the bulk.
Yeah. So you said that you wanted your boundary Hamiltonian to be local because you wanted it to be close to your CFT. So does the boundary Hamiltonian get, you do the approximation, recreate any features of the CFT?
No, and that's one of the places where we think these toy models might break down. So is one of the things we're looking at the moment is can we incorporate more symmetries into these boundary models? And if not, maybe that's telling us something interesting. I think in one dimension they have, so there's some tensor network toy models that map from two dimensions to one dimensions where they've got kind of a discrete approximation to conformal symmetry on the boundary. But what they don't have is an error correcting code. So we're looking at can we combine these two systems together so you get both? And if so, oh, that would be interesting, and if not, I think it'll be interesting. So either way, hopefully you'll be telling us something.
Any other questions? Atlas, thank you, Mark.
Thank you.